Hello again, and welcome to The Economist magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm volunteer reader Steve Veach. Thanks for tuning in. During the next hour, you'll hear articles from the August 15th to August 21st edition of the magazine. On the cover this week, a photograph in black and white of a woman dressed in a burqa, very discreetly looking out of a window. It looks as if she is living in hiding. The headline, Inside Afghanistan, a report on 5 years of Taliban rule. The cover leader, the Taliban are vile. Democracies must still engage with them. 5 years after America's exit, the Afghan regime is not going anywhere. That will be followed by four additional leader articles, starting out with Marco's Method. America really might restore democracy to Venezuela. Thank Marco Rubio, but beware the caprice of his boss. Then Tariff Man returns. A bill to punish Putin gives too much power to Donald Trump. Walloping the global trading system is no way to help Ukraine. Then, Sheikhs versus China. China has wrested control of oil markets from OPEC. When market power comes from buying power, oil importers can do better. And then finally, screening for success in praise of designer-ish babies. Couples should be allowed to select embryos on the basis of both disease resistance and IQ. After that, we'll go to the United States section for Reap What You Sow. For a different kind of democratic insurgency, look to Iowa. Republican policies have left a red state reeling. Will voters spring for change? Then to the Americas section for A Bridge Too Far. Donald Trump's bullying of Canada is endless. Canadians are starting to turn against Mark Carney's pragmatic response. And then, time permitting, to the culture section for Booked and Easy. Travel agents are in demand, especially for luxury trips. AI can try, but humans still have the edge when it comes to booking holidays. So that is our lineup, and we'll go back to the top for the cover leader. The Taliban are vile. Democracies must still engage with them. 5 years after America's exit, the Afghan regime is not going anywhere. 5 years ago, President Joe Biden pulled American troops out of Afghanistan. He was not forced to. America could have defended Afghanistan's flawed but democratically elected government indefinitely, but chose not to. Voters were weary of America's longest war against the Taliban, a militia that controlled much of the countryside. Donald Trump set a timetable for pulling out. Mr. Biden did so completely. America's looming departure prompted every Afghan with a gun to revise their expectations about who was likely to win their country's civil war. Warlords switched sides. Government soldiers abandoned their posts and melted away. The government fell almost immediately. The Taliban seized power almost unopposed. Desperate civilians fleeing their new rulers clung to the wheels of a departing American plane and plunged to their deaths. The Taliban, whose name means religious students, had first seized power in 1996 and imposed a brutal blend of Islamism and pre-modern tribal custom, banning girls' education and stoning gay people to death. America and its allies overthrew them after they hosted Al-Qaeda, the terrorist group that attacked America with hijacked planes in September 2001. But Taliban fighters then waged a guerrilla war against the democratic system that America had introduced, murdering judges, police, and anyone deemed a collaborator. When Mr. Biden gave up, a two-decade effort at nation-building ended in humiliation. Other powers drew conclusions about America's willingness to stand by its friends. 6 months later, Vladimir Putin invaded Ukraine. 5 years on, America has largely forgotten Afghanistan. This is a mistake. The country is more likely to cause geopolitical trouble again if it is ignored. Its people will suffer even more, and it is more likely to fall into China's or Russia's orbit. As our correspondent reports this week, after a 1,000-kilometer road trip inside the country, the Taliban are firmly in charge, and the place is largely calm, bar intermittent sparring with its neighbor Pakistan. But it is a grim stability. Music is banned. Armed men rule the streets. The vice and virtue police dish out beatings to sinners, such as men with inadequate beards. Women are barred from workplaces, universities, and travel without a male guardian. Girls are banned from secondary school, and, since child marriage is now legal, many have been forced straight from the classroom into wedlock. How much poorer, sicker, and sadder all this has made Afghans is hard to say. Data gathering is not a Taliban priority. Most Afghans yearn for more freedom. Even many Talibs, after years in exile, no longer believe that the sky will fall if girls can spell. But hardliners have ruthlessly asserted control. The Taliban's emir, Haybatullah Akhundzada, has recruited a loyal Praetorian guard and grabbed lucrative mining contracts. More moderate Talibs are generally too weak or scared to challenge him. Some of the few who did had to flee. America and Europe have tried to isolate the Taliban regime, refusing to recognize it, freezing Afghan central bank reserves held abroad, and slapping sanctions on officials. But this has achieved almost nothing. Taliban hardliners do not mind if Western diplomats and investors stay away, and will not adjust their ideology just to lay hands on the old government's assets. So Western countries must try something new. This means recognizing some hard truths. First, the Taliban are not going anywhere. Second, if the West does not engage with them, other powers will. Russia has formally recognized them. China, India, Turkey, and the United Arab Emirates work with them on issues such as mining and trade. The Taliban threatened to destabilize relations between India and Pakistan, since the latter fears that closer ties between Delhi and Kabul could leave it sandwiched between enemies. Hints of a more hard-nosed Western approach are starting to be visible. Europeans still say the Afghan regime is beyond the pale, yet in June they invited Taliban officials to Brussels to discuss migrant flows and repatriating failed asylum seekers. America quietly shares intelligence with them in the fight against even more extreme Islamist groups. Other forms of engagement would also make sense. It is too soon to unfreeze the $4.2 billion of Afghan central bank reserves in Switzerland, which would surely be used to prop up the execrable emir. But donors should stop cutting humanitarian aid, which has fallen by around 70% since 2022. Nearly half the population needs it, by one estimate. It is also useful to have UN agencies on the ground, with eyes and ears to warn of looming famine, unrest, or the theft of aid. A second step would be sanctions reform. Many senior Talibs, who were put under sanctions decades ago as terrorists, are now ministers. That is having the unintended effect of locking the country out of the global financial system and starving it of private investment. Western firms fear to do any kind of business in Afghanistan in case they fall foul of terrorist financing rules. Changing this could boost growth, which might eventually ease the mass joblessness that threatens the country's long-term stability. A more controversial step would be diplomatic recognition. This does not imply approval. Decent governments recognize many regimes they despise. Rather, it means accepting the reality that the Taliban are likely to rule Afghanistan for the foreseeable future. Withholding diplomatic ties is not much of a bargaining chip. The Taliban do not think their legitimacy depends on the say-so of infidels. However, functioning embassies can watch out for terrorist threats and create useful channels of communication, which in time could encourage the regime's more moderate elements. Make no mistake, reform of this vile government must come largely from within, and could be the work of decades. But judicious engagement is likely to do more good than harm. So it is time for America and other democracies to hold their collective noses and talk to the Taliban. That was the cover leader. The Taliban are vile. Democracies must still engage with them. 5 years after America's exit, the Afghan regime is not going anywhere. And we'll turn now to leader article number 2. Marco's method. America really might restore democracy to Venezuela. Thank Marco Rubio, but beware the caprice of his boss. When President Donald Trump sent American special forces to snatch Venezuela's dictator, Nicolas Maduro, in January, it did not sound as though restoring democracy was his priority. He boasted endlessly about how he now controlled Venezuela's oil, while barely mentioning the country's political future. He installed as interim president Delcy Rodriguez, the deposed despot's dismal deputy. Many worry that without a strong American commitment to a democratic transition, the old brutal kleptocracy would carry on. Yet, the prospects for democracy in Venezuela seem to be improving. This is not because Mr. Trump has suddenly developed a passion for the subject. It is because his Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, who really does care about ending left-wing dictatorships in Latin America, has been granted a reasonably free hand to use America's huge influence in pursuit of that goal. A first round of negotiations between Venezuela's regime and figures from the opposition ended on August 12th with a modest agreement to begin a process of judicial reform, including of the Supreme Court. Our reporting finds reasons for optimism. Further talks could produce, by December, reforms that could allow for fair elections. None of this would be happening without pressure from the United States. Mr. Rubio has been deeply involved, speaking directly to the opposition's lead negotiator, Dinora Figuera. Her team moves around Caracas in American cars, with American security, and sleeps in America's chosen hotel. Having seen both their liberty and the economy shrink under Mr. Maduro, the vast majority of Venezuelans would love the transition to democracy to succeed. This would also benefit Mr. Trump. He wants to see Venezuela's dilapidated oil fields boom. Only under democracy and the rule of law will the country be stable enough to attract the necessary investment. Problems abound, however. The ruling clique has often broken promises to allow fair elections. An opposition directed by Mr. Rubio will be accused of being an American stooge. It does not help that ordinary Venezuelans, many of them earthquake-battered, have yet to see much benefit from the oil revenues controlled by the United States. If negotiations drag on, the regime will have more chances to escape its commitments, and the opposition may be weakened. So speed matters. America should insist that Venezuela will hold a presidential election in 2027. That is more than enough time. After the fall of the Berlin Wall, several former Soviet vassal states organized free elections within a year. In the meantime, the United States must disclose how much oil money it has collected, how much has been returned to Venezuela, and which sanctions impede disbursement. An elected government should take full control of the oil revenues from its first day in office. The opposition leader, Maria Corina Machado, must also be allowed to return home quickly. Mr. Rubio may want to keep her away from the negotiating table in order to make it easier to talk to the regime, but keeping her in exile is short-sighted. The regime needs confidence that any deal also binds Ms. Machado, even if she negotiates through proxies, as she may well be Venezuela's next president. Otherwise, she could repudiate its possible terms, such as safe exile for regime figures, though she insists she is not out for revenge. Ms. Machado's presence in Venezuela would also help allay another worry, Mr. Trump's caprice. He has spoken of making Venezuela the 51st state, and sometimes suggests that its oil wealth belongs to the United States. For now, he is allowing Mr. Rubio to pursue more noble aims. If he changes his mind, the only thing that might save Venezuelan democracy is Ms. Machado's ability to summon huge crowds to the streets. That was Leader Article number 2, Marco's Method. America really might restore democracy to Venezuela. Thank Marco Rubio, but beware the caprice of his boss. And we move on now to Leader Article number 3. Tariff Man Returns. A bill to punish Putin gives too much power to Donald Trump. Walloping the global trading system is no way to help Ukraine. Vladimir Putin will not end his war on Ukraine until he believes the costs of fighting on exceed the costs of stopping. The costs to him, that is. Russia's president cares nothing for the Ukrainian lives he is ruining, and precious little for all the Russian blood and treasure he is wasting in pursuit of a warped idea of personal glory. So Ukraine and its backers must somehow convince him that he will never win, and that continuing to try will only weaken him. On August 7th, America's Senate passed a bill designed to send that message. The Lindsey O. Graham Sanctioning Russia and Iran Act, named after a senator who was a champion of Ukraine until he died in July, directs America's president to take more forceful action against Russia. As its title suggests, it includes new sanctions on Mr. Putin and other Russian bigwigs, as well as on Russian energy projects and financial institutions. The aim is to punish Russia for as long as it fails to make peace with Ukraine, and to signal that America will not abandon Mr. Putin's courageous victims. The bill, which senators approved by a hefty 86 votes to 11, was a rare example of bipartisanship in a rancorously divided nation. Unfortunately, its current form is deeply flawed. The main worry is that it gives America's president new powers to impose tariffs. Levies of up to 100% may be slapped on the top 5 importers of Russian energy and on any country that helps Russia evade sanctions. The president may waive tariffs if he deems it, quote, in the national interests of the United States, or adjust them if a country has taken, quote, significant steps to increase or decrease the import or transfer of Russian oil or gas. That is a lot of discretion for Congress to give to anyone, let alone to Donald Trump. The reasoning went something like this. Sanctions do not seem to have improved Mr. Putin's behavior. It is tricky to block Russian oil exports given the large, hard-to-police so-called shadow fleet of tankers that shipped the stuff illicitly. So the late Senator Graham and Richard Blumenthal, a Democrat who co-sponsored the bill, included a new weapon, tariffs on countries that buy Russian hydrocarbons. The danger is that Mr. Trump will interpret the national interest clause creatively. He has form. The Supreme Court in February struck down his previous claim that declaring an economic emergency, in this case America's trade deficit, allowed him to impose tariffs as he saw fit. This fanciful legal theory had enabled Mr. Trump to threaten to hurt any country that displeased him. A handy way to extract concessions for America and for himself. Since the justices thwarted this power grab, Mr. Trump has been trying to reimpose tariffs under a patchwork of other legal justifications, with mixed success. The new bill could restore to the president a chunk of the power the Supreme Court rightly took away. That would be bad for American consumers, who might face higher prices. It would be worse for the global trading system, which would once again be at the mercy of the, quote, tariff man, as Mr. Trump has dubbed himself. As drafted, the bill raises the specter of a new trade war with India, unless Mr. Trump sensibly chooses not to wage one. The legislation must now get through the House of Representatives, which should remove the parts about tariffs. Meanwhile, there are other, cannier steps that Washington could take to help Ukraine. One is practical. The country is struggling to fend off deadly volleys of Russian missiles without American-made Patriot interceptors to blast them from the sky. America has few to spare, since so many have been used up during Mr. Trump's war on Iran. But Washington could agree to license their production to Ukraine, allowing Ukrainians to beef up their own defenses. The other way to help Ukraine is less concrete. Mr. Putin needs to be persuaded that America and Europe will never let Ukraine lose. Given Mr. Trump's wildly inconsistent stances on the war and apparent desire to be liked by Mr. Putin, that is hard. But Congress, which will be around long after Mr. Trump has left the White House, could send useful signals. The larger the majorities it can muster for supporting Ukraine, the sooner Mr. Putin will realize that it is time to cut his losses. That was Leader Article Number 3, Tariff Man Returns. A bill to punish Putin gives too much power to Donald Trump. Walloping the global trading system is no way to help Ukraine. We'll move on now to Leader Article Number 4, Sheikhs versus China. China has wrested control of oil markets from OPEC. When market power comes from buying power, oil importers can do better. The great economic surprise of the Iran war has been that oil prices have stayed relatively contained, even with the Strait of Hormuz mostly shut. 5 months into the war, Brent crude remains about $40 below the $126 per barrel intraday high it hit on April 30th. For a while, there was even a, quote, mini-glut of crude oil. As a result, motorists and oil importers have not yet faced a severe crunch. And, though it may seem difficult to believe, Iran has had less leverage over President Donald Trump than it might have done. For the reprieve, the world can thank China. When Iran started pointing its drones and missiles at tankers crossing the strait, 14 million barrels per day of crude oil, roughly one-fifth of world output, risked being trapped in the Gulf. Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, or UAE, soon redirected about 5 million barrels per day via pipelines. Strategic stock releases by rich countries, including America and Japan, covered another chunk. But the biggest shock absorber has been the near halving of China's crude oil imports to 5.5 million barrels per day. curtailing China's imports has been a feat of state engineering, achieved by releasing stocks, restricting exports, and managing demand. It is worrying when China's autocratic rulers have such a firm grip on any market. They often use their leverage in the global economy, from being the biggest importer of barley to refining more rare earth elements than anyone else, to bully critics and impose costs on countries that irk them. The Iran war, though, has shown that oil consumers can benefit when big buyers exercise their market power. For decades, the king of the oil markets has been the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, or OPEC. Together with its allies, which include Russia, the cartel controlled around half of global crude production before the war. OPEC usually aims to keep prices artificially high by agreeing to restrictive quotas on production, often coordinating output cuts, though occasionally it has done the reverse, allowing Saudi Arabia to flood the market to try to kill off rivals, notably American shale. The cartel's manipulation of the market is like a tax on the global economy. Estimates of the economic damage it causes range from fairly modest to a hefty $5.7 trillion between 1970 and 2014, or 0.15% of global GDP each year. China's oil strategy, by contrast, has proven helpful this year. Its accumulation of vast stocks when prices were low will have imposed a small cost on the global economy at the time. But dampening price spikes is correspondingly beneficial. If China ends up smoothing peaks and troughs in prices, it could make investments in new sources of supply easier to plan. Trying to buy low and sell high can go wrong, as any speculator knows. Thankfully, it is China that bears that risk and the costs of storage. The balance of power in oil markets may shift again. For a while, once the Gulf crisis abates, there could be a, quote, super glut of crude, which was originally forecast for 2026. OPEC will also be weaker than it was before the war. The UAE, once its third largest producer, quit the cartel in May, and other members are itching to pump more. Yet, over time, the supply of oil may contract faster than demand, and China's role in influencing the latter could shrink. Every 2 years, as oil fields deplete, the world loses one Saudi Arabia's worth of crude supply. At a global level, investment is inadequate to replace those barrels beyond 2030. This could tilt the balance of power back to the cartel, because the Gulf state-owned giants are among the few still investing in ambitious new projects. Its share of supply will rise. At the same time, China's demand could fall, owing to the advancing electrification of its economy. It might judge that it needs fewer reserves. If so, it will buy less during gluts and cut imports by fewer barrels during a crisis, meaning it no longer absorbs as much of an oil price shock. China has shielded oil markets from the effects of the Iran war out of pure self-interest. Its export controls have left diesel, petrol, and kerosene in much shorter supply than they would usually be at today's crude oil price. It also keeps information about its stocks scarce, so America and others do not know how long it could withstand sanctions or war. That makes the oil market harder to anticipate. But the consequences of its interventions have bought other oil importers time. They should use it to diversify their sources of supply and reduce their oil consumption. the simplest way for them to avoid dependency on any autocratic regime is to have less need for the black stuff in the first place. And that was Leader Article Number 4, Sheikhs versus China. China has wrested control of oil markets from OPEC. When market power comes from buying power, oil importers can do better. And this is a good time to pause and remind you that you're listening to The Economist magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This program featuring articles from the August 15th to August 21st edition of the magazine. And we'll continue on now with the last of our Leaders section articles, Leader Number 5, Screening for Success, in praise of designer-ish babies. Couples should be allowed to select embryos on the basis of both disease resistance and IQ. Having transformed human life, Silicon Valley is now coming for birth. A spate of startups offer screening services that allow couples having children via in vitro fertilization, or IVF, to assess embryos based on their genetic risk of diseases such as breast cancer and diabetes. Some venture further into science fiction territory, providing scores for IQ and height, or even eye and hair color. Critics are dismayed. Some worry firms are pushing immature technology onto vulnerable couples. Others say that even if the tech works, its use is immoral. Both arguments contain kernels of truth. Neither is ultimately convincing. Banning or heavily restricting embryo screening would be a mistake. For now, the debate is a niche concern. The startups mostly cater to the rich, famous, and odd. Yet that will change. A wave of investment means that the cost of IVF is likely to fall. If offered embryo screening at the same time, many couples will take it. One survey suggests that 3/4 of Americans support screening embryos for diseases. About a third say the same for non-disease traits. And that is before competitive pressure kicks in. Who wants to see their child bested by genetically selected classmates? Many medics, including nearly every genetics and reproductive medicine group in the rich world, question whether such, quote, polygenic prediction is ready for consumers. In Britain, where fertility is more regulated than in America, selecting an embryo on the basis of non-approved factors is unlawful. There are indeed reasons for caution. Polygenic scores are tricky. For many diseases caused by a single gene, testing offers near certainty. If the embryo has the material, it will develop the condition. Yet, an assessment of multiple genes leads to risk estimates rather than a binary answer, and such estimates are more accurate for people with European ancestry because they are better represented in genetic databases. Further caveats are in order. Risk reductions can look large in relative terms, but be small in absolute ones, particularly for rare diseases. Selecting for some traits may raise the risk of other less desirable ones. Even for highly genetically determined traits like height, parents remain limited by the range found in their own embryos. These facts are an argument for disclosure, however, rather than legal restrictions or outright bans. If companies want to offer polygenic scoring, they must adequately communicate the technology's limits and risks. They should also let their tests undergo independent scrutiny. This will not scupper a nascent business, since the startups are not, as some critics allege, selling snake oil. A study in 2019 found that parents choosing from among 10 embryos may be able to boost their child's height by 1 to 6 centimeters and IQ by between 1 and 7 points, with tech that is now nearly a decade old. As genetic databases get better and cover broader populations, and AI draws out the relationship between genes and traits, scores will improve. Such progress will raise difficult ethical questions. Some, including the, quote, Make America Healthy Again movement, argue that fertility tech corrupts what should be a natural process. Others worry that if polygenic screening is limited to the rich, their offspring will have another unfair advantage. The scariest critique is that fertility entrepreneurs are this century's eugenicists. But none of these arguments stands up to scrutiny. Quote, unnatural technology is already used in many modern births. This argument against embryo selection just as easily applies to IVF, for instance, which only zealots want banned. Costs could come down, making screening more widely available. And there is a big difference between the murderous coercion of early 20th century eugenics programs and parents seeking as much knowledge as possible when picking an embryo. Couples desperate for a clever child might be better advised to focus on what happens after birth. Yet, so long as parents understand there is no such thing as the perfect baby, the state should not stand in the way of a bit more information. That was Leader Article number 5, the last of our Leader Section articles in this program. Screening for Success, in praise of designer-ish babies. Couples should be allowed to select embryos on the basis of both disease resistance and IQ. And we'll move on now to the United States section for Reap What You Sow. For a different kind of Democratic insurgency, look to Iowa. Republican policies have left a red state reeling. Will voters spring for change? Rob Sands' campaign gimmicks, to the extent that he has them, are better suited for a Norman Rockwell painting than a TikTok feed. The Democratic candidate for governor of Iowa begins his town halls with a sing-along of America the Beautiful. He invites Republicans in the crowd to reveal themselves. Those who do are welcomed with applause. Yet the even-tempered Mr. Sand, who serves as the state's auditor, does not shy away from declaring a disaster where he sees one. Iowa, he insisted recently, is in the throes of three: an economic crisis, and a cancer crisis, and an education crisis. Many voters agree. Iowa has voted solidly Republican at the state and federal level for more than a decade. Republicans have dominated the state legislature since 2016. No Democrat has won the governorship since 2006, a Senate seat since 2008, or a congressional race since 2020. In the most recent presidential election, Donald Trump carried the state by more than 13 points. Yet Iowa is still home to a large block of independents, 35% of registered voters, and they appear to be swinging left. Mr. Sand is leading his Republican rival, according to an Emerson College Nexstar poll published on August 6th. Josh Turek, the Democratic Senate candidate, is in a tight race, and 3 out of 4 congressional districts are competitive. As the populist left advances elsewhere, Iowa is offering a different example of how Democrats might return to power. Their opportunity is born of growing discontent with Republican policies, state and national alike. The political affinity that many Iowans felt toward Mr. Trump is fading, with the president's net approval rating at -8. That's in part because the bite of his economic policies has sharpened, says David Peters, an agricultural and rural policy professor at Iowa State University. Last year, Iowa's soybean producers saw net farm income fall by half. This year, high fuel and fertilizer prices, inflated by the war in Iran, will make things worse. The administration's crackdown on immigration is exacting another cost, limiting labor available to Iowa's meatpacking plants. It is also deepening Iowa's broader population problem. Because of the long-term ebb of residents to other states, foreign immigrants represented a crucial source of new workers. Backlash is growing over environmental policy, too. The administration filed a brief seeking to limit cancer-related lawsuits against Bayer, a chemicals giant that produces a common pesticide. The Supreme Court sided with the company in June. But in Iowa, home to both mega farms and residents whose water is affected by their runoff, the issue is increasingly contentious. Iowa has the second highest cancer incidence in the country. Scientists don't know what, precisely, is driving this, but Iowa is one of only three states where rates are growing. For the past two summers, Des Moines has imposed restrictions on residents' water, citing high levels of nitrate found in fertilizer. You have 600,000 Iowans who can't use their water the way they might want to, says David Quirtney at the University of Iowa. If Mr. Trump seems more appealing to Iowans in theory than in practice, the record of Kim Reynolds, the state's outgoing Republican governor, has been even more repellent. Conservative landowners were incensed by her veto of a bill to impose additional restrictions on a pipeline for a carbon capture project. Moderate voters bristled at her restrictive new abortion policy, which bans the procedure after 6 weeks and allows an exception in instances of rape only if the crime is swiftly reported. A sweeping school voucher program has proved particularly polarizing. Iowa's public schools lost 13,000 students, or 3% of total enrollment, between 2022 and 2025. Some of that is down to population loss. However, school vouchers, introduced in 2023, have accelerated the decline. Under the scheme, the state gives any family, regardless of income, about $8,000 per student to put toward private education. Because the state funds schools on a per-pupil basis, a school that loses students loses money. Rural schools, already scraping by with tiny registrations, are further depleted, but the impact is broad. Just because you're a large district or in a metro area in Iowa doesn't mean you're not feeling the same pressure of enrollment loss, says Kurt Subra, the chief financial officer of West Des Moines Community Schools. At the end of May, Jenna Lewis, a second-grade teacher in central Iowa, got a job in Ames, a city of about 66,000 people. She was, quote, really excited, she says. Ames was a bigger, more affluent school district, and the position came with a $12,000 pay raise. 2 weeks later, the principal called to revoke the offer. Because of low enrollment numbers, the school was cutting her class. Presented with voters' frustration, Democrats are not so much grabbing the opportunity as greeting it politely. Mr. Turek, a state lawmaker, won his Trump-friendly district in 2022 by focusing on the economy. In his race for an open Senate seat against Ashley Hinson, a Republican congresswoman, he calls himself a, quote, prairie populist and talks about pocketbook issues, while suggesting that corruption is behind many of Iowans' struggles. Mr. Sand is trying to project himself as a nonpartisan pragmatist. In June, as state auditor, he released a report contending that nearly 80% of families who used vouchers in 2025 were already sending their kids to private schools, costing the state more than $250 million. The theme of corruption figures into his town halls. As a former public prosecutor, he has some credibility. But he avoids villainizing individuals. Instead, he blames a system propped up by, quote, two private clubs that exploit political tribalism, quote, to pick our pockets. He would not bring a Democratic agenda to Des Moines, he argues, but one grounded in independence and accountability. Matt Paul, a Democratic strategist in Des Moines, remembers working on Tom Vilsack's campaign for governor in 1998. Iowa had not elected a Democratic governor for more than 30 years. Tom's campaign came out with a very simple mantra, says Mr. Paul. It's time to rotate the crops. He notes that Mr. Sand and others have adopted the slogan. It feels a lot like 98 to me, he says. Independents who voted for Mr. Trump in 2024 now favor Mr. Sand by a 17-point margin. That was an article from the United States section, Reap What You Sow. For a different kind of Democratic insurgency, look to Iowa. Republican policies have left a red state reeling. Will voters spring for change? And we'll turn now to the Americas section for A Bridge Too Far. Donald Trump's bullying of Canada is endless. Canadians are starting to turn against Mark Carney's pragmatic response. The Gordie Howe International Bridge is a 2.5 kilometers long monument to the perils of appeasing Donald Trump. Canada footed the entire bill of $6.4 billion Canadian, or $4.6 billion U.S., for the gleaming new span over the Detroit River to the United States. But America's president threatened for months to block its opening, relenting only when the United States got a cut of the toll revenues. Traffic at last began to flow in late July. Canadians cringed at Mark Carney's evasive explanation for the shakedown. Mr. Trump then rewarded his compliance by announcing new tariffs of 50% on a range of goods imported into the United States from its northern neighbor. If the new tariffs come into force as expected on August 19th, Canada will be the first country to be subjected to tariffs under Section 338 of the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act, passed in 1930, allowing the American president to respond to perceived discrimination over trade. Tariffs under that act, unlike the emergency duties struck down by the U.S. Supreme Court in February, need no congressional approval. This looks a lot like the future of Donald Trump's trade policy because it gives him flexibility, says Eric Miller, head of the Rideau Potomac Strategy Group, a trade consultancy in Washington. Mr. Trump is using this freedom to put tariffs on $20 billion of exports to the United States, 5% of the total sent south every year. These would pile up next to other duties that have hobbled Canada's car, steel, aluminum, wood, and copper industries. Crucially, and unlike the emergency tariffs imposed last year, the new ones also hit goods covered by the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement, or USMCA, on trade. Mr. Carney may think he has room to negotiate. He needs it. He was elected last year partly because he stood up to Mr. Trump, promising to get, quote, an even better deal than the USMCA. Yet concession has followed concession. Canada dropped its digital services tax on mostly American social media giants, then ended most of its retaliatory tariffs and a different tax on streamers, such as Netflix. Mr. Trump's response has been indifference. "We don't need them," he said on July 28th, ahead of negotiations over the USMCA with Mexico as well as Canada. "The deal is important for them. It's not important for us," he said. This bullying appears to be hurting Mr. Carney at home, particularly over the Gordie Howe embarrassment. Canada agreed to pay for the bridge in 2012 as long as it took all toll revenue until costs were recovered. After Mr. Trump enforced a new deal, Mr. Carney claimed repeatedly that Canada's costs would still be paid first. A crowing tweet from Howard Lutnick, the U.S. Commerce Secretary, made clear it was untrue. "For the first 15 years of operation, the United States will take half of net revenue, after operating costs but before debt repayment. This will cost Canada some $300 million Canadian." The share of Canadians who say they feel confident that Mr. Carney can land a good deal with Mr. Trump fell by 8 percentage points between April and July, according to Angus Reid, a pollster. The same poll shows Canadians are still outraged by Mr. Trump's tariffs. Almost two-thirds want Mr. Carney to hit back with tariffs of his own. But that would only increase Canada's pain. "You've got to realize that punching the bully back here is also going to punch the Canadian people in the guts," says Justin Wolfers of the University of Michigan. Mr. Carney has sent negotiators to Washington to intensify discussions to extend USMCA. Mr. Trump's team declined to do this in early July. There is still a chance he could agree. Mr. Carney says he won't retaliate by playing Canada's strongest card, curbing exports of energy. In 1930, Canada did not show Mr. Carney's level of forbearance. It retaliated against Smoot-Hawley preemptively, launching tariffs of its own on American imports before the bill even had become law. Many other countries retaliated too. Within 4 years, the nominal value of world trade had fallen by two-thirds, and the global depression had hit its nadir. Unpleasant as it is, Canadians should hope that Mr. Carney's resolve holds, and everyone must hope that other world leaders are equally courageous when Mr. Trump turns his new tariffs on them. That was an article from the Americas section, A Bridge Too Far. Donald Trump's bullying of Canada is endless. Canadians are starting to turn against Mark Carney's pragmatic response. And we do have enough time for this article from the Culture section, Booked and Busy. Travel agents are in demand, especially for luxury trips. AI can try, but humans still have the edge when it comes to booking holidays. Not much can faze Olivia Ferney. The Canadian travel, quote, fixer is at the whim of her wealthy clients. Each one spends at least $1 million on travel every year, on top of a $100,000 subscription fee to her firm, Top-Tier Travel. The requests are lavish, fly to Paris to fetch a croissant, or ludicrous, call whoever you need to call to get it to stop raining. The escapades delight her roughly 2 million fans on social media and are even being adapted into a TV show. Travel agents often go above and beyond for their clients. That is in part why people still use them in an age of AI itineraries. In Britain, about a third of travelers booked their holidays through a human specialist last year, reckons ABTA, a British trade association. Across the pond, more than 310,000 agents are members of the American Society of Travel Advisors, another trade group, up from 190,000 in 2024. LinkedIn recently ranked the job one of the fastest growing in America, though the Bureau of Labor Statistics reckons it will grow more slowly than average in the period until 2034. People turn to travel advisors for their, quote, taste and judgment in curating trips, says Evan Frank, co-founder of Fora, a luxury host agency. Seasoned advisors have superior knowledge of particular countries and a network of exclusive hotels. Some stick to a particular niche, booking trips for people who have food allergies, or tourists who want to travel solo, or with their pets. Travel agents also provide an extra layer of support that many find reassuring. You can't call your AI if your room is wrong, or you missed your transfer, observes Mr. Frank. But a human advisor is there for any conundrum you might face, or croissant you might fancy. People are more likely to book with travel agents during geopolitical ructions or periods of extreme weather, when it feels riskier to make bookings. Advisors may be snarky about AI's shortcomings, but many use it in their work. Some agencies treat AI as a, quote, member of the team, says Mark Tanzer, boss of ABTA, getting bots to do the jobs humans find boring. Fora built a billion-dollar business by providing advisors with an AI platform that speeds up administrative tasks. As bots get better at planning trips, people may rely less on human advisors, but top-end services will probably endure. Ms. Fernie's clients enjoy being able to reach her, come rain or shine. That was an article from the Culture section. Booked and busy. Travel agents are in demand, especially for luxury trips. AI can try, but humans still have the edge when it comes to booking holidays. And that brings us to the end of our time for this program. Over the past hour, you've been listening to articles from the August 15th to August 21st edition of The Economist, the weekly news magazine from Great Britain. I'm Steve Veitch, and it has been my pleasure to read them. Thanks for listening. Tune in next week for another reading of The Economist, and I'll be back with you in 2 weeks. And as always, I remind you that if you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand. In fact, you can listen to this and most other Sun Sounds programs at your convenience with On Demand. Just go to sunsounds.org/broadcastinfoandaudio/ On Demand.